Welcome to The Business of Medicine with Sharon Hollander. This is the show that reveals the behind-the-scenes secrets of healthcare. With the changing rules, regulations, and challenges facing healthcare, you can't afford to miss this information. Now, here's Sharon Hollander.
Thank you and good morning. Welcome to our show, The Business of Medicine. Today we have a very exciting topic. I have a guest that will be coming on later on the show, Mary Pat Whalen, who is an expert and a consultant in the area of practice management. She has over 25 years experience, and she's going to be sharing with us her 10 predictions of what medical practices are going to be doing in the year 2014. So we'll look forward to that. A couple of things that I wanted to talk about. First, I wanted to thank everybody for reaching out and communicating with me. And if you'd like to do so, please feel free to email me at sharon@sharonhollander.com. Check out my blog, also available at www.sharonhollander.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Hollander Sharon or on Facebook. So one of the things that was very apparent to me when I was doing research on my book, Medical Billing Horror Stories, are some what I'm calling plagues that plague medical practices. So that these are issues that seem to be common, if not prevalent, in many medical offices in the United States. So one of the first things that can make or break a physician's offices is, I guess, would be the same thing in any business, and that would be employee turnover. It's typical, most healthcare organizations, for some reason, have a very high turnover rate. And in physician offices, it seems to be like a two-year longevity for many employees. And that costs thousands, if not more than that, for typical medical practice. You know, it's not only just the training, but it's also the representation that you're doing in front of your patients. So that if you went to, as a patient, if you went to a medical office and each time you got there, there was a new person greeting you at the front desk, that would negatively impact your impression of that physician's office. In addition, you're dealing with training issues. You're dealing with employees who may or may not know what your procedures are, and that ultimately will reflect in how successful you run your physician's office. Another thing that is very, very important, and that's cash flow delays. Obviously, there's a big difference between, I had a conversation once with a provider, and we argued back and forth between the difference between income and cash flow. And he was saying that as long as he made more money in the long run, he had more money. But I was like, if you have money in your bank, in your hand this month, then you have more income if your cash flow is higher. And, you know, we obviously went back and forth on this argument, and I don't think either of us won the discussion. But it's really important for physicians to have a good handle on their cash flow. And so, especially with changes in reimbursement and third-party payers, it's really important for them to, you know, submit claims electronically so that you're decreasing your cash flow delays. Collecting copays and payments up front is really important also to alleviate some cash flow delays. The other thing that's common to many physician practices are what I'm calling the high demands on limited time. So, you know, if you compare practices that were in existence maybe even as recently as 10 years ago, there were less demands, less paperwork. You know, the average person, I've discussed this before, the average person that goes to a physician's office probably generates 7 pieces of paper. Now with, you know, even though with the internet, you're supposed to have a streamline of checking patient eligibility and being able to do some of the functions that used to be strictly on the phone. Now over the internet, there's still an unbelievable amount of delays and paperwork and time and effort needed to just manage a physician's office. So for instance, you know, some providers like to have their patients reminded of appointments. So that's could be a few hours of time on the phone, contacting the patients, leaving messages, having them return calls, filling out paperwork. You know, before I used to pick up the phone and say, okay, this patient needs an MRI or an X-ray, and the receptionist would just pick up the phone and call and get an X-ray. Now they need to contact the insurance company, get an authorization, contact the MRI or the radiology department, provide all this information. Sometimes they have to fax requisitions back and forth. What used to be a simple phone call to schedule an X-ray can now be somewhere anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes of the person's time. And it's not only the physician offices that sucking up time, but also the physicians themselves, because many times they'll have to get on the phone and talk to another doctor. They'll have to talk to the lab. They have to talk to the insurance company. Sometimes you have a situation where the physicians cannot get an authorization for something unless they speak directly to the medical director at an insurance company. And you can just imagine what of a hassle that is, both for the provider and for the patient who's waiting for their authorization to come through. The other issue that I want to talk about are contracting issues. There's not a day that doesn't go by that I'm not asked by a provider what their reimbursement is going to be for a specific surgery or charge. And because of that, you know, the first thing that we do is we go and we review their contracts of who they've signed professional PPO agreements with, provider organizations. So basically what a PPO is that the insurance company asks the provider, are you willing to see our patients for a discount? And many times the physician will say yes, they've agreed to the discount. And that's what's called the PPO contractual adjustment. And sometimes, you know, going back to my previous statement about employee turnover, many times you have a situation where the previous employee is the one that negotiated a contract for the provider and the reimbursement is way too low. We had a situation recently where we did some number crunching and we found out that this one practice who in his perception he was seeing PPO patients ended up having all his PPO contracts being negotiated at 100% of Medicare rates, which means basically his practice was 100% Medicare, even though he was under the impression that he was getting, you know, good PPO insurance from those patients. So it's really important to keep track of all the contracting issues as such. And then one of the last things that I want to talk about, which doesn't affect all providers, but it's something that is a huge, huge issue in healthcare and specifically physician offices. And that's employee embezzlement and theft. And I have some shocking statistics. This was done according to a Medical Group Management Association, the MGMA organization, did a study on how many physician offices were actually a victim of embezzlement. And they found out that 17% of all physician offices had embezzlement or were the victim of some type of theft, primarily from their own employees. And so the study was conducted in 2009, and of all the practices that were analyzed, they found out that there was $94 million of money that had been embezzled from these physicians. And in 74% of the cases, it was less than $100,000. And in 26%, it was greater than $100,000. And primarily, I would say almost half of the embezzlement was from copays. So what happens is that the employee, obviously the patient comes in, they pay cash, you know, they write a receipt or they destroy, they neglect to give the patient a receipt. There's some mechanism in which they take the copay but don't credit it to the patient account and just stick it in their own pocket. And that happens, like I said, 44% of the time, according to this one study. And then the other areas where physicians are being embezzled by are either 18% of forged checks and 10% of some payroll scheme, or they've added employees that were not necessarily employees of that provider offices and paying out payroll to bogus or non-qualifying employees. Interestingly enough, it was an equal distribution between receptionists and billing employees. So it's really important for physicians' offices that are working with employees to make sure that there are checks and balances in place and that they're not suspect to stealing your money, because obviously no one wants that to happen. And the other thing that was really interesting to me was that in many of these cases, the physicians had an outside accountant or an accounting firm, and many of those did not catch this embezzlement. So there's two things to learn from this. Obviously, it's very prevalent in the physician offices, and it's something that, you know, can get sneak by. You know, at the end of the day, $20, if somebody pockets it, $20 in copays, you know, that's like, it'll add up to thousands of dollars over the course of the year. Anyway, so it's really important for providers, like I said, to be in charge of their cash flow so they make sure that they're not victims to this. What's also interesting about this study was they have the breakdown of family practice, which was 10%, and surgeons, which were also 10%. And, you know, you might also want to know, like, the distribution and what states. So the number 5 states that had the highest incidence are Texas, California, Florida, Ohio, and North Carolina. So that's quite an interesting statistic. Anyway, as I mentioned, I am really pleased. We're going to take a short break in just a few minutes. And when we come back, I'm going to have my guest, Mary Pat Whaley, co-founder and president of Manage My Practice, who, as I mentioned earlier, has over 25 years as a board certified in medical practice management. And she's a fellow of the American College of Medical Practice Executives, as well as a certified coder. Currently, she's on the advisory board for the Mayo Clinic on their social media campaign, and she's a social media guru with having over 30,000 users and visitors to her blog, as well as 60,000+ followers on her LinkedIn network. She is ranked as a thought leader on LinkedIn, and I'm very excited that we have her today to be our guest and talk to us about her predictions for physician offices in 2014. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with Mary Pat Whalen. Thanks.
Welcome back to the Business of Medicine on Talk Zone. Here's Sharon Hollander.
Hi, this is Sharon Hollander. If you've just joined us, we're in conversation, and we're welcoming our guest, Mary Pat Whaley, who, as I mentioned, is co-founder and president of Manage My Practice. Today, Mary Pat is going to talk to us about her predictions for physician offices in 2014. Good morning, Mary Pat, and welcome to our show.
Good morning, Sharon. Thanks so much for inviting me to be with you today.
It's our pleasure. Thanks for coming. So before the break, I just talked briefly about some of the issues that plague many of the medical practices, and I gave some statistics about a study that MGMA had conducted about how embezzlement was a big issue for small and solo practitioners. But, you know, we're facing new things in 2014. One of the biggest things, obviously, is the ICD-10 conversion. So tell us a little bit about how you came up with these 10 predictions, and let's just jump right into them.
Sure. Well, the 10 predictions are the things that my partner, Abraham Whaley, and I feel like are going to be very critical for practices this year. Some of the things like you talked about, the ICD-10, the conversion to ICD-10 in October is definitely going to be big, but that's really only one part of what we call the year of the government mandate. But let me start at prediction number one, which is we're going to see a lot more cash practices this year. Many more practices are going to add a cash component to their practice, and it could be that they are going to go to 100% cash practice and not accept insurance payments. It could be that they're going to add a cash component for telemedicine, for emails or texting. It could be a direct primary care model where the cash either augments or replaces the insurance payment. But a lot of practices are really going to focus on either services that insurance companies do not pay for, or an add-on to services that insurance companies do not pay enough for. So I see this as something that a lot of practices are going to change to this year.
I know I have a lot of discussion with physicians who ask me, like, what's going to happen to their patient mix if they decide to stop taking insurance? Do you have any feedback? Or obviously it varies from patient to patient and surgeon to surgeon or doctor to doctor, but do you have any trends or any insight in what would happen if a doctor just decided that he wasn't going to take insurance anymore?
Well, we have a couple different models that physicians who don't take insurance anymore follow, but what we find is that if physicians are not filing any insurance claims, and if they're not having to jump through all the hoops that payers make them jump through, that their overhead goes down significantly. Physicians can, you know, spend not only a lot of time, but a lot of money and resources and staff time to do what needs to be done to get claims paid by insurance. So, you know, the physician office bears a huge brunt of expense for taking payments for insurance, and a lot of times those payments are not up to par with what providing the service actually costs the physicians. So when a physician wants to stop filing insurance or not take insurance, we have to look first of all at their specialty. Obviously, it's the very rare surgeon who is not going to take insurance, because surgical procedures are quite expensive overall, and patients typically need the insurance to pay for a large portion of surgery. So when we look at who is not going to take insurance, it is more typically the primary care or the medicine subspecialties. Excuse me.
That's interesting. You would think that intuitively it would be the reverse, because if you have a highly specialized surgeon has less competition, then he feels like he could not take insurance because people need him. But it's more the cost of what his service is, right? Is that what you're saying?
There's no question that there are some surgeons. Someone mentioned to me the other day about a surgeon who costs $30,000, you know, cash to do the surgery. But let's not forget, when you have a surgery, it's not just the physician's efforts. It's also facility fees and other staff fees, OR fees, implant fees, drugs, all that kind of stuff. So as opposed to a primary care physician who does not necessarily, they might have an EKG or some lab tests, but, you know, they are not
as expensive,
not involved with the big fees that having the facility side of things wrapped into it does. So even when a practice goes all insurance, or excuse me, no insurance, all cash, you know, there's going to be something that isn't covered. The patient still has to have the insurance to cover, whether it's MRIs or other imaging tests, other kind of diagnostics, you know, hospital stays, things like that. So, you know, there is a limited application to the cash practice. And it does competition. I think that you brought up a great point. Competition is a big thing. You know, there will be some people who will go to a cash practice if they feel that the value is there. But if they feel the same value can be received from another provider who takes insurance and isn't cash, you know, then they're going to go to that provider probably. So there is a lot to it. It's not as straightforward as, you know, build it and they will come. Everybody knows that's not the way healthcare is anymore. But we know that physicians are leaving practice or retiring or, you know, going to work for hospitals, you know, because they're having a hard time making it in traditional practice. And so some of them are choosing to add a cash component to their practice. And, you know, sometimes you can make as much money seeing 100 patients if they all pay in full, as you can see in 150 patients who don't all pay in full. That's kind of aside from the cash piece. But, you know, a lot of physicians end up leaving a lot of money on the table because patients don't prioritize paying them. So, so that's prediction number one, is the cash side of things. Prediction number two, we know there are less physicians, there are not enough physicians to meet the needs, and that shortage is anticipated to intensify in coming years. And one of the things that we see that is coming back into vogue is group visits. I have been a part of practices as far back as about 10 years that we're doing group visits. But it hasn't caught on as much as I think we're going to see a lot more of it this year. The group visit model is where you have a group of, say, 12 to 15 patients who come to a visit that's about 90 minutes long, sometimes as long as 2 hours, 90 minutes to 2 hours. And during the course of those 90 minutes to 2 hours, patients will rotate through several different kind of stations. They'll go into a private exam room for a physical exam. They will, you know, get their vitals taken. They will do some education pieces. They'll do some sort of round table sharing kind of things. So it's a very expanded visit for each patient, but because it's being done in a group, the physician has the opportunity to provide the services and then to charge for a higher level of service for each patient at the same time.
But they wouldn't necessarily use a group CPT code because those would be limited to like counseling codes or education codes, correct?
Right.
They would still use their evaluation and management code?
You'd be
for everybody in the group.
EM code. Right, an E&M code, and most likely coding by time.
That's an interesting concept. Do you know anybody that's doing that model right now?
Yeah, actually, I know of a fair number of people. In OBGYN, they call those, I think they call them centering visits. I just had somebody comment on that today. I published my predictions on LinkedIn and SlideShare, and a lot of people have commented on the group visits because they haven't heard of them before, but OBGYN has been doing group visits. I've read a fair amount about them, and patients seem to really like them. Of course, that's a situation where moms, you know, future moms or current moms with new babies coming have the opportunity to really share a lot of information together, and just like in diabetes, which is one probably the longest time ago, the group visit that I participated in as a administrative person was the diabetic group visit. Patients feel like they get more out of it. Physicians feel like they have a better connection to the patient, and they're able to spend more time with the patient. And it may not be for everybody, but for a lot of patients, they just really like it a lot.
Okay, that sounds great. And let's move on to your next prediction.
Prediction number three, I call it independence will not die. Physicians will hold on to their independence via a variety of practice models. We have seen some interesting, we have some old timers, and then we have some interesting different models that are coming up. We have been setting up a lot of physicians in solo practice, which surprises a lot of people because all they hear about is that hospitals are buying physician practices, and they don't hear that physicians are leaving the hospital and starting their own solo practices again. So we've got some very lean solo practices where they can do the startup for a relatively small amount of money. We definitely have independent physician organizations or independent physician associations where they're not part of the same practice, but they are able to leverage the power of many practices for services and for goods. We've had physician service agreements where physicians provide services to hospitals. They're not owned by the hospital, but they have an agreement with them to provide services to the hospital and their patients. In many places, those are working very well. Of course, accountable care organizations, we are seeing those come into play. More ACOs start up, and practices can be a part of an ACO without being owned by the hospital, or the ACO can actually be run by the practices. And something that I find particularly interesting are single tax ID organizations, where groups come together under a single tax ID and to share services and goods, but they actually run their own practices independently underneath a single tax ID. So those are some of the models we are seeing that physicians have the opportunity to remain independent or become independent from hospitals in some different kind of ways.
It looks like we have to take just a quick short break, and we'll be back. Thank you for listening. You're listening to Sharon Hollander on TalkZone.com.
And now, more of the business of medicine on TalkZone.com. Here's Sharon Hollander.
Thank you, and welcome back to the show. Before the break, we were talking to Mary Pat Whaley about her 10 predictions for medical practices in 2014. Mary Pat, before the break, you had mentioned something about ACOs, which are accountable care organizations. Could you just briefly outline for some of our listeners what that entails, because I know a lot of physicians are either misinformed or they have an unclear understanding about what that organization entails.
Sure. An accountable care organization is a group of care providers that come together to provide a better level of care for patients, and it could be a very specific group of patients, for instance, diabetic patients, or it could be Medicare-aged patients, or it could be patients that are subscribers or beneficiaries of a particular payer. So the ACO does a negotiation for a group of services, which may include inpatient, outpatient, physician clinic, may include home health, skilled nursing facilities, kind of the continuum of care for patients. They may come together and negotiate kind of for the whole care spectrum for patients, as I said, could be with certain chronic illnesses or some other similarity. And so there is a payment, a group payment or a bundled payment for a patient's care for the year for that chronic disease, let's say. And so the whole organization does a really good job of coordinating care, so there's no duplication of tests and those kind of things, and they have very good outcomes. And what they do is, besides negotiating a bundled rate for care management, disease management, they also have the potential to benefit, to be a partner in the sharing of any savings that come from providing better care at less cost. So there's lots of different kinds of groupings, but to be an ACO, you have to be registered with the government. And so if you want more information on ACOs, you can Google accountable care organizations and Medicare or federal government, and you'll get a lot of good information about those.
So, but it's sort of like a DRG for physicians, right?
Yeah, that's, you know, for anybody who understands what DRGs are, there are some similarities there.
Anyway, sorry I interrupt. So let's get back to your, I think we're up to number four on your predictions.
Prediction number four is time of service payments are critical. And I think this is extremely important. People are waking up in January of 2014 and getting patients with very high deductibles and saying, wait a minute, I really need to get my act together with time of service payments. So we are seeing people investing in some sophisticated software and also doing some sort of manual things to have a better handle on getting paid at time of service in physician practices. You know, a lot
now,
of people
has
don't
it been, go ahead. Has it been your experience that a physician's office can collect Medicare deductibles?
Absolutely.
In advance of,
there's no question
in
about it. A lot of people are very, very confused about that. And a lot of Medicare patients don't even realize what their deductible is.
Right.
But yes. Coinsurance, co-pays if it's a Medicare Advantage product, and deductibles, absolutely. Medicare encourages you to collect at time of service.
Interesting. And they would do that based on the allowed amount from the published fee schedule, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And this is where a lot of people have trouble with time of service collections, is if they have a lot of different contracts out there, their system may not be able to predict what the payment is going to be and what the deductible is going to apply to and what it is not. And so if you don't have good practice management software that has some of those estimating tools, one of the ways that we work with our clients to do collections is to eliminate the statement process and to take on a credit card on file program and keep the patient's credit card on file, so that if the estimation is off or if they do not want to estimate at time of service what the patient owes, they are able to, once the claim pays, they are able to put the balance on the patient's credit card. And there are rules surrounding that, of course. I mean, there are, I don't, you know, advise people just to charge any balance, regardless of the amount, to a credit card on file program. You discuss with patients, you know, what you're expecting their payer to pay on the claim charges and what you expect their balance to be. And if that's not the way it comes out, then you call the patient, you give them a courtesy call and talk to them about it. But I think we're going to see a lot more credit card on file programs, because physicians can't afford to send statements and wait for 90, 120, you know, 200 days or more to get their payment.
Right. I know that that's a growing trend here in California, that a lot of physicians are starting to migrate. But one of the complicated things about collecting the Medicare deductible is if there is supplemental insurance, some supplemental insurances will pay for the patient's deductible and some will not. And so I know physicians, the ones that I know, they hate doing patient refunds.
Yeah, I typically do not necessarily recommend that anybody that has Medicaid and Medigap or supplemental or secondary insurance collect anything at time of service, because that can be really confusing. And sometimes the patient doesn't owe anything at the end of the day, and sometimes, you know, it's $10 or $12. And that's another great thing for credit card on file, is you may not collect anything at the time of service, but you have the ability, when Medicare pays 15 days later, if there is a balance, to put that on the credit card. By the same token, if somebody accidentally overcollects, you can refund it right back to that credit card within 24 hours of receiving the explanation of benefits. So just as you are asking patients to pay at time of service, as soon as you know they need a refund, you can make that happen.
Right. My next prediction is my favorite because, of course, you know, I run a billing service.
Right. So the next prediction is number 5, which is outsourcing. And, you know, outsourcing has taken on a whole new meaning. I think that many people, of course, are very familiar with outsourcing their billing. But what a lot of people don't know is that they can outsource many other things. They can outsource appointment scheduling, nurse triage. There's so many different ways that technology can help practices that, you know, they just have to kind of wake up and smell the coffee. I've been in many, many practices where the physicians say, no, I want them here. I want to see them working. And that's just not... you know, you just can't make it anymore with an office full of people. You know, you want your
now,
office
you give,
to be...
Can you give us an idea, like, the logistics on how outsourcing a nurse triage would work?
Sure. There are a couple different models, and one is a nurse triage service that could be used during the day, but could also be used just in the evenings and weekends when the office isn't open, where there are qualified, licensed nurses who are going to take the calls, and based on the instructions that the practice gives them, they are going to dispense advice and decide, you know, when the physician should be called and when the physician does not need to be called. Another model is for the practice to have their own triage software, and there's some great programs out there now, where it could be a licensed nurse who is an employee or a contract person that's dialing in and using your own triage software to log the call and log the advice that was given and send to the physician whose patient it is to review. So they could also be, you know, your very own staff who used to work in the office and now they work at home.
Right. Oh, but it's always over the phone, right? Because, see, when you first said triage, I thought, that's interesting, like, how you would do that virtually, but I get it.
Yeah, phone triage.
Yeah, okay. That makes more sense.
So number 6, prediction number 6 is the healthcare cloud is here. And we have actually been working with the cloud in our consulting practice since the very beginning. That was one of the first things that we started with 3 years ago. And at the time, 3 years ago, people were just starting to hear the word and really didn't know much about it. The cloud has really gone mainstream in healthcare now. For the first time, we have a vendor who will sign a HIPAA Business Associates Agreement and will agree, you know, to keep secure and HIPAA-compliant patient records, all kinds of office financials, anything that they want to put in the cloud. You know, we're at the point now where small practices cannot justify the investment in hardware that it takes to, you know, keep their systems on site. And, you know, mid to large practices are really looking for the flexibility and the mobile advantages that the cloud has to offer. So we're definitely starting to see the move to the cloud, whether it is practice management and EMR software that just happens to reside on the cloud, or whether it's a cloud provider like Box, which is what we use, where people can put their purge charts they don't want to put in their EMR, you know, any paper that's in their office can be stored in the cloud.
It looks like that we have to take another short break, but please join us back when we return. You're listening to Sharon Hollander at TalkZone.com.
You're listening to The Business of Medicine on TalkZone.com. Back to Sharon Hollander.
Welcome back to the show. If you've just joined us, we're talking to Mary Pat Whaley about her 10 predictions for medical practices in 2014. And now we're going to go up to number 7, which is what, Ms. Mary Pat?
Number 7 is the value paradigm. And we touched on this a little bit when we talked about ACOs a couple minutes ago. I think just about everyone has heard that healthcare is moving from volume to value. In other words, from you know, the more you see the patient, the more money you make, to value, you know, the more you demonstrate your ability to care for patients in a cost-effective and good outcome kind of way, the better off you'll be. So some practices will be part of ACOs, and some practices will be negotiating independently with payers, and they will be expected to demonstrate, you know, value to patients and to payers. And so that does mean population management. I talked about duplication of tests. You know, a lot of waste in healthcare. We all know that. Keeping patients out of the hospital, out of the emergency room, treating them at lower costs, more appropriate levels. And then, of course, the big one, you know, focus on prevention and wellness.
Yeah, that would be good.
And prediction number 8 is, you and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, talking about ICD-10. Prediction number 8 is this is the year of the government mandate. It's kind of a tsunami year for government mandates, and we really think it's going to push some practices over the edge into opting out of Medicare. Practices are, I mean, their heads are just spinning. They are trying to continue to see Medicare patients when they can because the payment is very low, but also comply with all the other mandates to keep that payment intact, sometimes to get additional incentives. But as time goes on, the incentives drop off, and, you know, the payment adjustments, which I put quotes around because that's what they call dinging you for not doing something they want you to do. So, of course, we have meaningful use. Then we have physician PQRS, which is the Physician Quality Reporting System, which ties in very much to the value-based modifier that is starting this year for the smaller groups. Groups of 100-plus have been working with this, but the smaller groups now are going to have to jump into the game. HIPAA, of course, which is quite detailed and in-depth, and for a lot of small practices, the risk analysis that's required for HIPAA and for meaningful use can be a real challenge. And then we come to ICD-10, which is a big deal. It's, right. You know, certainly a new set of codes that everybody has to learn and be trained on. But even more than that, it's such a huge change for our reimbursement system that I think most people are very concerned that practices are going to have a hard time in the fourth quarter of next year with money. You know, this is one of the reasons why I encourage everybody to do credit card on file, is because they're going to need kind of a war chest to get through ICD-10 this year.
Now, I mean, there's still rumors that it's going to be delayed again. And I read recently about, you know, the fact that the government was on furlough for some months last year. Do you really think that they're going to keep it hard and fast to this October 1st deadline?
I do think that it will be steadfast. I think that I have certainly heard, I haven't heard any rumors. I mean, I've heard people asking any possibility because they want to delay the, you know, the whole thing. But I also know there is a campaign afoot to try to release the physicians from having to comply, the practices from having to comply with ICD-10 and just make it for hospitals, because that is the way it's used in many other countries. Mm-hmm. But I have a feeling, you know, we've gone too far down this road and that it won't change. Time will tell. You never say never. But right now, we feel like it is going to go forward in October of this year.
Well, I know some physicians that aren't planning on learning it until September 30th, just in case they get a stay of execution.
Well, I, you know,
and they shall remain nameless.
Money in the bank.
They shall remain nameless.
Yep. Well, that's part of risk management. You know, you have to decide how risk tolerant you are, and if they don't give them a stay. And it does go forward in October, you know, what's the potential risk to your practice? You always have to consider that.
Yeah, they'll call their billing company.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
In the middle of the night, no doubt.
So prediction number 9 is social media makes sense. And certainly we have a lot of people who have embraced social media in healthcare. And of course, we've had some bad results, but a lot of physicians have had some really good results. So we really encourage practices to engage with current and future patients on social media platforms. And we think that it does 3 big things for practices that they need to buy into this year. We think that we know that it communicates medical, nutritional, and specialty health information to patients in a place they're looking for it. I love when physicians do videos or FAQs for patients for the information that they're always calling the physician for. They may still want to call the physician to ask the question, but that information is available on their website and maybe on their Facebook page if they take the time to put it there. You know, they need to establish a digital presence. They need to let the internet know that they are there, and they need to let patients know that they are there and establish their authority. And, of course, as a marketing tool, it's, you know, it's beyond compare. We started our marketing or our consulting practice 3 years ago, and we have clients all over the United States, and we do no advertising except for through social media. And so I think we are the proof. People only hear about us from the internet. So we like to teach practices how to do what we've done, and we feel like they need to, for the most part, get out of the yellow pages and get onto the internet.
Well, you know, I've been told by my family that I'm not allowed to say anything disparaging, especially about their technological skills. But I love it when my mother said to me, "Did you chirp?" And I said that
I chirp.
So I said, "What?" She goes, "You know, the bird thing." I said, "Oh, you mean tweet?" She called it chirping.
At least she's there. You know, she may not have exactly the right word, but you got to it, didn't you?
Yeah, she had the bird down right.
So my last prediction is physicians leaving hospital employment. And we believe this is going to intensify in 2014. You know, physicians for the most part are leaving the hospital willingly, but I think we're going to see more physicians being released from employment this year as hospitals really struggle with reimbursement issues They're going to decide that they have physicians who are not performing, and, you know, they're going to fire them. We're going to see this in a lot of different places across the United States. So we think that, you know, this is at least the third cycle of hospitals buying physician practices and then finding that, you know, it's not the same. Managing physician practices and managing hospitals are two totally different things. So we think that we're going to see some weeding out of physicians, and that physicians who are working in the hospital are kind of waking up to, hey, I can actually start a solo practice. I can rent space from another physician that's not using their exam rooms all the time. You know, I can get a free EMR. I can, you know, communicate with my patients using technology. They can return to practice, you know, for as little as $20,000 and start over again. And in the past, it's taken physicians 5 or 6, sometimes more times that, to start a practice or to buy into a practice. So we think we're going to continue to see an exodus, both voluntarily and involuntarily.
It's interesting because, you know, my niche as a billing company has been solo practitioners and small groups. And so I've seen trends over the last 20 years on where nobody wanted to be a solo practitioner. And now it seems like the pendulum has swung the other way and people want to be in solo practice.
I think so. I think that for the physicians that we set up in solo practice, a lot of them are saying, I'm not practicing medicine the way I want to in the hospital. I don't want to be required to see so many patients an hour. I don't want to have to always look at my watch. I don't want to have to jump through this hoop. I don't want to have to be on this committee. I don't want to have to do that. And physicians are deciding, and we also see the trend of physicians and their spouses going into practice together, where one will be the physician and the spouse, whether it's the husband or the wife, will manage the practice for them. So we teach a lot of new managing spouses how to manage practices, and it's really going very, very well. And that makes it very affordable for them as well.
Well, you know, having spouses in the practice is a whole other topic for another day. But it looks like that we're almost out of time. Before we conclude, though, is there some place that people that want additional information can reach out to you? And please give us your Twitter and LinkedIn information, your blog.
Yeah, our website and our blog is at www.managemypractice.com. And excuse me, we have a Facebook group. We have a LinkedIn group. As you were kind enough to mention earlier, I am a healthcare LinkedIn thought influencer. So you can follow me on LinkedIn as well as connecting with me on LinkedIn. On Twitter, my name is Mary Pat Whaley with an underscore in between Mary and Pat, and Pat and Whaley. And I'm also on Google Plus, and love to connect with practice managers, physicians, administrators, vendors, people that have an interest in the private practice. We consider ourselves physician advocates because we really believe that we need to keep physicians, maybe not all physicians, but we have to keep that private practice going. We feel like that's in the best interest of all patients to continue to support private practice.
Well, thank you, Mary Pat. You've been an excellent guest, and I really enjoyed our discussion. You're listening to The Business of Medicine on TalkZone.com.